So Al, 15, what were the new things that happened in 15? We talked early on from, you know, the Mercury to Gemini and so forth. What did what had happened before allow you to do on 15?
Okay, what 15 was a new model of spacecraft. We were upgraded. We carried a lot of extra equipment that had never been carried before, as you know. We carried the first lunar rover, the little electric car that they drove on the surface. That gave them quite an extended capability on the lunar surface. And we carried a scientific instrument package into lunar orbit. In that, we had, kind of interesting, we had two large cameras. The large camera, which is a high-resolution camera, was one that had been developed back in the 1950s by a company in Boston called Icon. And it was a Ball Optical camera, but it was a camera that was designed to be flown in U-2 aircraft at 60, 70,000 feet. And the Air Force had declared it obsolete before our flight, so we were able to get it on our flight. And I've often wondered what, when the Air Force declared that obsolete, I've always been curious about what they replaced it with, because it had to be something pretty spectacular. Because I could take a picture from 60 miles of objects on the lunar surface down to about 4 feet. I actually have pictures of the lunar module, or the lunar rover, sitting next to the lunar module at the landing site for Apollo 15. I took about pictures of with that high-resolution camera of about 25% of the moon's surface. And along with that, we had a mapping camera that did the same thing, except it took individual frames along the trajectory. And it had a laser altimeter associated with it that recorded the altitude, if you will, of the film above the ground. And then I had a series of, I think, six or seven, I forget now the exact number, but of remote sensors that were all on arms that I could extend, like the Canada arm kind of thing. And we had microwave, we had X-ray, we had alpha particle, we had mass spectrometer, we had all these things. In fact, I'll tell you about the mass spectrometer. Mass spectrometer is an interesting answer. Oops. Your phone, Dave.
Ooh, sorry about that.
Is that the next question coming up? We had the mass spectrometer we took because we were just playing around with seeing if there was anything in the lunar atmosphere. We really spent a lot of time in the science on our flight. And so I'd stick the mass spectrometer out for a while and, you know, say, you know, what's going on. And they actually picked up some stuff in lunar orbit, I think. If we go back and check the records, Gene, I think we'll find it, where they found something in lunar orbit, which is not supposed to be there, but it turned out to be urine. And it was a result of a urine dump that we had done a couple of revs before that, and stuff was still floating around out there in lunar orbit. So we actually recorded a little of us from lunar orbit. But those are the things we carried. Now, the lunar rover was a very, very interesting device. It was a little electric car that folded up almost into a suitcase size. I think it weighed about 480 pounds, something like that. It was built by Boeing, but Boeing at the time, in fact, one of the big reasons that we started switching flights around was the lunar module was late, and that caused the 8-9 shift. But we thought the lunar rover was going to be late too. So we got a hold of the General Motors people and asked them if they could help. And we ended up taking it down to Santa Barbara to the GM test range down there. And I'm trying to think, the fellow that ran that test range ended up as an administrator of NASA, I believe. Anyway, within about a month they fixed it and we were all set to go. So it worked out really well.
Did you go out to retrieve film? Did you do an EVA?
Yeah, I did a spacewalk on the way back home. Kind of an interesting process there. It leads me to talk about a kind of a thing with me. God bless engineers. They make everything that we use. I don't know how many are out here, but we would not have done any of the flights if it hadn't been for the engineers. But somebody has to sit on the engineers to keep them real, okay? Because I think engineers can go out a little ways if they are given the opportunity. Well, I had a system by which I was going to recover all this film, And the system had already been prescribed before I got on a flight. And the system basically was an endless clothesline. I was to take out a pulley with a clothesline on it, take it out, and put it in a mount on the outside of the space of the back of the service module, and one in the hatch. And Jim Irwin put one in the hatch. And then I'd walk out or float out there, and I would take the canister, which is about 90 pounds. It's a pretty good sized canister, and clip it onto this clothesline, and then Jim would pull this thing back into the hatch and stow it inside the command module so we could get it back through the atmosphere. Well, I took a look at that and I said, I don't like that. There's something wrong with it. It's not going to work. I don't think it's going to work right. Well, we have tested it completely in the water tank. We know it's going to work. Oh, well, let me ask you, what was the weight of the cassette that you put in it? Well, we made it out of Teflon, and we cut a lot of holes in it to make it neutrally buoyant. And I said, you're using that as what's going to happen in space when you got 90 pounds instead of this lightweight thing. Well, we think it'll work. And I said, I don't think it will. So I insisted on going in a zero-G airplane. And as a matter of fact, that particular flight, I think, was that one. We set the world's record for the most number of zero-G flights. Harry Andonian from Dayton came down and flew the airplane. And we did 125 parabolas that day. And there's a picture around somewhere that I think will attest to the fact. But anyway, the reason we took so long was I wanted to make sure this thing was either going to work or not. So we got into it, and it was very interesting to me because it's about a 30-foot stretch from the hatch back to where the film cassettes were. And so that clothesline was 30 feet. And I said, I don't believe, since there's no friction in space, you've got this 90-pound mass. We don't know what that mass is going to do. If there's any jerking on the rope at all, we got a problem. And sure enough, the thing got halfway back, and a little jerk on the rope, and the thing started swaying back and forth, and it actually knocked the RCS quad right off the side of the service module. So we said, I think we proved the point. We can't do that. So I said, okay, we got to do something simple. Let's do it from an engineering standpoint, but it's got to be simple. Give me a wrist tether with a hook, and I'll carry the damn thing back. All I got to do is hold on to it, float back, give it to Jim, go back out, and get the other one. I had two cassettes. So I said, okay, we'll give that a whirl. So I had this wrist tether, and it had a little hook on it, and the engineers came back, and I said, the safety people come back, and I said, well, we like the idea of doing that, but we don't think it's very safe, because if you hit that hook, it could come undone and you'd lose the cassette. And I said, okay, what do you want to do? And they said, we want to put a hole in the hinge and put a pin in it. Okay, that's fine. I'll go along with that. I mean, that's an extra precaution. So about 2 weeks went by, and I came back again, and they said, we are still not happy with it. I said, what's the problem? Well, we think that the pin is great, but we want to drill a hole in the end of the pin and put a cotter key in that so the pin won't come out. And think, Jesus, where are we going to end this thing anyway? I mean, how far do we have to go? But the point was that I had this idea that the right engineering solution is the one that makes the most sense and is logical and is simple. And that's how you get things to work.
How'd you make it?
Yeah, it worked. Anyway, the AVA was fine. I went out a couple of times. One of the problems I ran into is that I had trained too well for it, so in 37 minutes I was done. And I'm thinking, holy mackerel, now what do I do? I'd love to, I did go back out a third time, put my feet in some foot restraints and look out, and it was unbelievable because I could see both the Earth and the Moon at the same time. They were in my field of view.
Wow.
You got to think about that a little bit, but that's a pretty unique place to be.
Wow. To all of you, what did it do to you, all of you, to look back at Earth, Walt, and see it?
Well, frankly, in these days, when I look back at the whole program, our time has changed, society has changed, NASA has changed. I just feel fortunate to have lived when I did and have had the opportunity to do what I did with Apollo.
Yep.
Dave, I think I think it's one of I watched Earth Rise 75 times, and that's the most magnificent thing you can see. It's the only thing in our sky that has color like we see here on Earth. But I will tell you, the thing that impressed me more than looking at the Earth was looking at the universe out there. That to me was the most important part of the flight for me. There's a part of the trajectory around behind the moon, or a quarter section, where I was shadowed from both the Earth and the sun, from the albedo of the Earth and from the sunlight. So I was in total darkness, and the thing, and I'm sure we've all seen that, but if you look at the sky out there, if you're in that section of the trajectory and you look at the sky out there, you can't make out a single star because it's just a wash of light out there because there's so many stars out there. And it makes you think, you know, we are a very, very small part in a very, very big universe here. We're part of the Milky Way galaxy, of course, but we're about two-thirds of the way out on an arm. We are a little planet with a planetary system, but if you were to count the number of suns or stars or whatever you want to call them, stars, let's say, in the Milky Way galaxy, you're talking about 400 billion stars. And if you start looking at the number of galaxies out there, you're looking at what we know of today, what they can see and what they can measure out there, even with a Hubble, we're talking a couple of hundred billion. So you're looking at the number of stars. It goes back, I think we all remember talking to Carl Sagan about that. Carl had this idea that there are so many suns out there that have planetary systems, and of those there are so many planets that could sustain life. And no matter what number you assign to that, you come up with a positive number for a planet out there somewhere that's going to have intelligent life. You can't get away from that fact.
Yeah. I do still have one thought that I would like to leave with them, because as we look at that, and the reason I said that, how fortunate I feel to have lived with the program when I did, in history's shake, 500 years from now, I personally believe there's only one thing they're going to be remembering about the 20th century,